In the third hour on Wednesdays, we generally welcome our next guest, Dr. Aaron Carroll, although he hasn't been here in a couple of weeks. Last week, we had his colleague, his cohort, his friend Austin Fracht, who works with him at the Incidental Economist blog. Aaron Carroll is a professor of pediatrics. He's a doctor. He is the director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University School of Medicine. He's also an author. He's written a couple of books now, co-authored a couple of books that debunk medical myths. They're called Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. And the sequel is Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. His blog is now appearing at the New York Times as well. He's a contributor to what's called The Upshot at thenewyorktimes.com, which is basically as good as it gets, and we haven't touched him on the air. I've touched him off the air about that, but congratulations. Explain, I asked Austin last week, what you guys are doing at the New York Times now.
So we're going to be contributors, meaning that we'll probably together write, I don't know, 60 columns a year for their site over the next year. So the Incidental Economist will continue just like it was before. It's just that a little more than probably once a week, we will also be writing for the New York Times. And actually, they're going to let us repost the stuff back at the Incidental Economist anyway. So it's a total win-win for us.
How much of a big deal is that to you? You wrote about it. So.
Huge. I mean, this is a big deal for me. There's still that level of, like, you know, if you're just writing for a blog, regardless of how well the blog is received, it's still writing for a blog. Writing for the New York Times or, you know, any large media market is sort of the next level, but we were super excited to be part of this. David Leonhardt, who is running The Upshot, totally gets what we do. He's getting together a great panel of people that I totally respect to contribute. Brendan Nyhan, whose research I've cited tons of times. Justin Wolfers, who's an economist that I think is fantastic. There's Michael Bishlas, who is a historian, written tons of books. So, I mean, it's a great group of people. Josh Barrow has joined it as well, some other journalists that I think are phenomenal. So it's just great. I'm super excited. Great to be a part of it.
All right. So what is this big deal on the Incidental Economist right now about e-cigarettes, where there's some new research about e-cigarettes, but what you're writing is that everybody's when you blog about this, you're getting all kinds of hate. What's going on?
It's a very organized group of people, because you just mentioned e-cigarettes on Twitter or on the blog, and they just come out on force.
Well, you have to know, but what's the issue though?
Well, there's e-cigarettes have been becoming more and more popular, and there's a growing body of people who believe that they serve a public good because they have the potential to be less dangerous than cigarettes because they don't have perhaps as many of the dangerous components in their smoke. And there are also people that advocate and say that they're a great way to help people quit, to transition from cigarette smoking to something less harmful perhaps, and then eventually to stopping smoking altogether. That's fine. But my issue is just that, every time I sort of review the literature that's out there, there's very little evidence that any of what I just said is true. It does appear through some laboratory studies that they are perhaps less harmful, but all of the claims of, that they're going to be a phenomenal way to help people transition to quit are not terribly well supported by evidence. And I just keep saying I'd like to see the evidence before we go crazy, because at the moment they're not as well regulated. They are still pushed, kids are using them. There's uptake of them, and it's like we don't want to leave them, just hanging out there and sort of not as well regulated perhaps as cigarettes are, when they could be a hazard if they actually get people to start traditional smoking. Like, we just don't have enough evidence. So I keep promising myself I'm not going to touch this anymore, because man, does it bring out.
Well, what kind of a reaction does, basically you're saying that there's not.
I said that the studies that I keep seeing that keep coming out keep sort of pointing to the fact that there isn't good evidence that they are leading people to quit, and that they, are this sort of great tool to get people off cigarettes. And
that they're not as bad for you, right?
Well, there is some evidence, I will say, that say they're not as bad. I mean, and it makes sense, because, like, they're not putting out as many of, you're not getting all of the filler and everything, all the other stuff that's in tobacco. It's just really sort of nicotine and that's it. Hopefully much less. So you're not getting as much smoke, and technically a lot of the smoke, it's not necessarily the nicotine, is what's carcinogenic and causing so many health problems. There's arguments to be made that there's not as much secondhand smoke, which is likely true. And so it doesn't pose as much of a health hazard, perhaps, to people who are around you. So I buy all these arguments, and it's like, and if they wanted to treat them just like cigarettes and sell them just like cigarettes and let people use them, I'd be okay with it. But there's sort of this push to make them safe and wonderful, and it's like, well, that's not necessarily the case, nor are they these sort of great quit aids. And so when I posted yesterday, I was just sort of commenting on a study. It was a reasonable study that people did where they got 1,000 people in a survey, and they checked them, and then they said, are you smoking? Are you trying to quit? Are you using, e-cigs to help you quit? They asked all kinds of questions, and they checked in with them a year later. And they found that, you know, some things were predictive of quitting, like intention to quit, but that e-cigarettes didn't help. So what I said was like, look, this study is not providing any evidence that they help you to quit, and it adds to sort of the evidence base that says they don't. They really need to prove that this works, and people go crazy. They just, you know, start attacking you. They say you don't understand science, that why the study is flawed. And I admit it's not an RCT. It's not a perfect study. But if they were phenomenal quit aids, you would hope to see an association. You don't see an association, which means either it's not there or the effect size is pretty small. And they're acting much in the same way that the people have always acted with traditional cigarettes. It's like, well, you don't have an RCT proving they hurt people, so therefore you can't prove they hurt people. It's like, yeah, we're not going to – we could get one of this, but we're not – we don't have one yet. Do one, and if you do, I'll own that.
A randomized controlled trial, right.
Until we have that, we have to use the best available evidence. And that, you know, the building body of evidence is saying they're not great quit aids, or you haven't figured out how to use them as great quit aids yet. And if that's the case, people should stop overselling them.
Melanie, how many Twitter followers is Dr. Aaron Carroll up to right now? Let's see if we can improve that by the time the replay is over. Those of you listening on the replay, at Aaron E. Carroll is joining us. Right now, we're just mentioning e-cigarettes, which he's getting accosted. I've already got a couple of phone calls, didn't even say the number yet, so you're right about these e-cigarette people. And I'll go to one or two of them. And then, of course, we want to talk with you about the Hobby Lobby case, the Affordable Care Act, the other challenge to it as well that I sent you this morning that you already knew about, of course. 866-994-6343. Any questions for Dr. Aaron Carroll? Every time he's on, almost every Wednesday in the third hour here, we take a lot of phone calls. So by all means, he is great at accessing information that he doesn't maybe have in his mind very quickly. So anything you want to talk about, at Aaron E. Carroll, what did you find? Melanie, you there yet?
No, he has 10,000.
10,700. Congratulations.
Followers.
Wow, 10,400?
700, but I can't see the
all right.
Full numbers.
Ken in Virginia, you're on Stand Up With at Aaron E. Carroll.
Good morning. Dr. Carroll, let me ask you this question. Now, I am an e-smoker, and it's helped me. I've tried the patch, I tried the gum, I tried that drug, I forget what it's called, but it gives you bad dreams. I've tried them all. It hasn't worked for me, but the e-cigarettes have. And what I like about it is you can start off at 30 milligrams of nicotine and go down to zero, which I am at.
Okay.
Now, my question to you is, you say there aren't enough studies on e-cigs. Maybe that's because, well, let me ask you, you know, when it comes down to other products out there, like you got the big pharmaceutical companies, they will pump their money into it to prove that their product works.
Correct. Do you think tobacco companies, which basically, by the way, have been buying up e-cig companies like crazy, don't have the money to fund the studies if they thought they would work?
Well, you know what? They got the best of both worlds. They sell the cigarettes.
That's exactly right. I'm not arguing. I totally agree with you. Plus, I want everyone to hear this.
Well,
I'm not asking us to ban e-cigarettes. I'm not trying to ban them. I'm not. I just think that they should be sold like cigarettes and not like great things which are helpful and don't need to be regulated.
How are you? What do you mean? How are they?
Like cigarettes, you can't buy them if you're under the age of 18.
That's by the way regulated in different ways in different states. But they are the way that they are advertised is not regulated the same way. The way that they are sold is not regulated the same way. If they were treated exactly, no one is trying to ban them. Nobody. It's just.
Is that your concern, Ken?
What's the argument for what? Why they should be regulated like cigarettes and why they shouldn't be regulated like other things?
Yeah.
Food?
I mean, Nicorette's not regulated.
Sure it is.
The hell it is. I can go to any drugstore and buy it, so can kids, just like I can do a cigarette.
I didn't say that, like, first of all, you can't just go into any drugstore and buy it. It's the same way you can go into a drugstore and buy cigarettes. But the way it is advertised, studies had to be done showing that it helped people quit before they could actually say we can go out and do things to show that they help people quit.
Okay, what's that drug, Santex?
Yeah, that's a totally regulated drug, dude.
Yeah, it's a totally regulated drug, but look at all the side effects.
I'm not arguing again. It's like I'm not. See, you're trying to. I am not saying we should ban e-cigarettes.
I'm not saying that you're saying you should ban it, but I mean here's something that's working for a lot of us, and it's like, you know, everybody wants to grab control of it.
No, I just think it should be regulated the same way that cigarettes are regulated.
All right, but thanks, Ken. Brian in Maryland.
Hey, how's it going? Good morning, guys.
Hey, Brian. Oh, I wish you had the last caller's phone connection.
Hey, I just wanted to say I quit January 11th smoking, and I've been vaping since then. And that would be my first point of clarification, is it's not smoking. It's a vaporizer, for one thing.
The e-cigarette is a vaporizer?
Yeah, that's correct. It vaporizes propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings, and nicotine. So it's not actual smoke. It doesn't burn.
This is like you're picking at sort of the nuances of all of it when the main point remains.
That's a very important distinction. That's not a subtle nuance between.
Why should it be not? Does that mean that dip shouldn't be regulated because it's not smoking, or that we shouldn't regulate other forms of tobacco because they're not smoking?
Well, I don't disagree that they should be regulated.
No one is saying cigarettes enjoy protected status because they are smoking and therefore all other forms of tobacco are free reign. It's tobacco. Tobacco is regulated in a certain way.
Yeah, I don't disagree that e-cigarettes shouldn't regulate because it's got nicotine in it.
Well,
we agree.
So, thanks, Brian. So, what about how come there isn't more research on vaporizing any kind of tobacco or marijuana versus smoking it? You know, you would think that vaporizing would be healthier than smoking.
There are, as I said, some laboratory studies. But again, we can't do – okay, in order to do studies to see, like, does it cause cancer, you'd need, like, 30-year studies. No one is funding or doing that at the moment. It is not like you take up smoking and you get cancer the next year.
Right.
It's a long time coming.
Right.
You could do studies even of, like, does it affect, you know, with respect to lung function and asthma and stuff. But those studies, one, cost a fairly large amount of money, and no one is really willing to fund them at the moment. They also are difficult to do. So you have to have someone who wants to do it. The government probably isn't very interested at the moment at funding studies trying to prove these things are safe. That's not when they could actually be funding, like, medication to cure disease. So it's not likely it's going to happen. And as your other caller said, right now the tobacco companies are enjoying the best of both worlds. They're buying up e-cigarette companies, and therefore they can sell product to both sides. And why would they do it? I'm not even faulting them from a moral standpoint. There's no economic reason for them to fund those kinds of studies. So how do you do them? Big randomized controlled trials cost millions of dollars. It's very unlikely that that's going to happen anytime in the near future. But again, it's like it is. Your callers keep coming up and saying, like, I use it and I love it. I don't doubt that at all. I love Scotch. But I don't go around talking about how, like, you know, everyone needs to get their hands off Scotch. Scotch is not alcohol. Scotch should be free and it should be everywhere and we should all just be thrilled about it. It's Scotch and I don't want it to be banned. I don't want it to be taken away from me. I just want to own that it's like, you know, it is what it is and should be regulated like the rest of alcohol. I think that e-cigarettes at the moment are not a wonderful drug to help people quit smoking. That has not been proven. And just because there is anecdotal evidence that says that it can doesn't mean that it's also not perhaps, you know, slightly addictive and perhaps transitioning some people in the other direction. We just don't know. And I think that people keep asking for it to be sort of in this protected class of it only has benefits and almost no harms, when truly that is just not known.
It's hard to talk about abortion. Obviously, it's always difficult, and people have obviously a number of different points of views on it. But when it comes to this case that was argued yesterday before the Supreme Court, the Hobby Lobby case, you're the expert. What are the drugs that are covered by the Affordable Care Act that Hobby Lobby does not want their employees, that they don't want to pay for? And why? Because I'm also reading yesterday, there's an interesting story in Mother Jones magazine that says until 2012, Hobby Lobby's health insurance plan used to cover
they totally did
the morning after pill, which does seem to me to insinuate what Professor Eric Siegel said yesterday, that this has more to do with politics than anything else. When it became Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. But that's weird, though, because why aren't they consistent? Usually abortion rights, anti-abortion people are pretty consistent on what in terms of what they believe, what procedure or what drug they don't like.
I do not believe that I don't know. You never know what's in someone's head. But it does appear to me that it's like that they've been inconsistent in what they believe. The problem is that I think that they probably didn't think too much about caring about what the insurance of their employees covered. In other words, they just bought a private insurance plan that was rated as comprehensive so they could be good employers, and that was that. And until 2012, I don't think they looked very deeply into the idea that, like, oh, my God, now they can use this to go get stuff I disapprove of. And I think it was well documented in a Wall Street Journal article I just recently read. You might have mentioned the same one, that until this lawyer from this advocacy group called and said, hey, you want to join the lawsuit, they didn't even know they were covering stuff that they didn't like. But this goes back to during the whole fight over you might remember with the Affordable Care Act, and they tried to say that the money that was going could be used for abortion, and there was a huge fight. And you might remember, I think it was the Republican National Party, all of a sudden realized that the private insurance they were providing their employees at the high level of the party was paying for abortions. And then they went into a tizzy, and they had to get that stricken out of it. This is just what insurance does. Insurance has covered a lot of this stuff for a long, long time, and it's only now that it's being seen through the lens of the Affordable Care Act that everybody is really getting up in arms about it.
Let's get to what what you're an expert on. And first of all, what's the difference between the birth control methods that insurance covers and where does, in this case, Hobby Lobby? Because there is a lot of nuance here, I believe, in that they're not against condoms or is it birth control pills? But you can buy condoms over the counter. Insurance, you don't need insurance for that, right?
No, and you also don't need to get a doctor's visit to get those drugs,
right?
To get birth control.
So
pills.
What are the different drugs, and then we can get into Ella and Plan B and what the company Hobby Lobby and others think those drugs do, and then what the science actually and what they actually do. But
there's a lot of different drugs for birth control. That's part of sort of the issue. The birth control pill basically works for the most part to try to prevent you from ovulating. So if a woman never ovulates, then there is no egg to go get fertilized by sperm.
And are they okay with that?
Well, you say they. The problem is it's like there's no they. It's like, different people have different views. There are people who believe all forms of birth control are wrong. There are people who will say that, then the pill is wrong, but condoms are okay because you could still have, they will start arguing theoretical things like the birth control pill has a secondary effect is it perhaps makes implantation more difficult. That even if the egg was fertilized, it would have difficulty and not implant, and therefore it would not a pregnancy that was viable would not result. And they will say, well, that's not okay. And it's all nuanced at the cellular level, and no one knows. So when you say, are they okay with it, I don't know.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Everybody has sort of a different view, but there are people who – where we get into trouble is that people will look at the pill and say it's an abort effect, meaning that what it does is it causes a pregnancy where an egg has been fertilized and it is implanted in the uterine wall. It causes that to be rejected, and they consider that to be abortion. And that's not really the case, and that's not sort of supported by science in the sense that that is how the birth control works. But they sort of come up with this theoretical, well, what if this happened, and then they want to get rid of it entirely.
Well, what is Ella? What is Plan B?
Plan B is basically you take a huge dose of the pill, which is immediately after, and what they're looking for there is to prevent implantation for the most part. In other words, if there was fertilization and if the egg was there, that the egg would never implant in the wall, and therefore the pregnancy would never work, really sort of set.
What are people's questions about these drugs? 866-994-6343. I like to argue, Aaron, that if you're anti-abortion, the best thing you can do is before birth control methods, before contraception. But a lot of people who are anti-abortion, not all, but a lot of people who are anti-abortion are also anti-sex. And they think some people believe that contraception, having contraception available, makes sex more likely, especially before marriage, which is what they're really against. I should say sex before marriage is more likely to happen. But, you know, the thing that I get very frustrated with is, if fine, if you're anti-abortion, you can't also be anti-contraception, because that's the way to prevent unwanted pregnancies and eventually an abortion. But I realize that a lot of the folks aren't going to be able to see that, make that compromise, I suppose.
You know what, and I should back up, because I just misspoke, and I don't even want to get into a fight over this, because it's like, the more I think about it, it's like the argument that I just made about implantation of the fertilized egg is the one that's actually people have been arguing, and that's why they argue that it is an abortifacient. And in fact, the FDA, if I remember correctly, the groups actually went out and actually said that the primary mechanism of action is that it doesn't do that. And so in product labeling, an editorial even have called on the FDA to remove from the labels the idea that it can prevent or inhibit implantation. And so there have been changes even in Europe saying that the drug will not prevent implantation of a fertilized egg. So in other words, the evidence backs up the idea that it doesn't even do that. It just keeps fertilization from happening. So it, in the strongest way, it looks that science is backing up that it's not an abortifacient. It doesn't sort of work to mess with the egg once it's been fertilized. It works to prevent ovulation from happening and therefore fertilization from occurring.
When you hear about people like Rick Santorum and others saying contraception is dangerous, or that contraception promotes sex or sex before marriage, is there any research that backs up those ideas?
No. In fact, the opposite is true. There's research, especially in kids, that shows that because this is the same argument that comes out with the HPV vaccine and things like that, that says that, you know, if we give girls the HPV vaccine, they will go have more sex. And it turns out that that's just not the case, and that's been proven in research and studies where they follow girls and they see who got the vaccine, who does not. What do? They don't engage in more sex. They don't get pregnant more often. They don't get more STDs. It is not related. Contraception, what it does is prevent pregnancy. That's what it does. And condoms also prevent sexually transmitted diseases from being passed, so they have an extra bonus. But that's what contraception does.
Well, the birth control pill also, I read something like 58% of women or something that use birth control don't use it to prevent pregnancy, but they use it for other hormonal issues and so on.
Well, I think, you know, the problem with – yes, and while I agree that there are women who use it for other issues, they also get the side benefit of you know, having birth control.
Okay.
But the number is greater than zero. Absolutely. There are women who need it for regulation of their periods because they have other issues for which taking the pill sort of helps regulate hormonal cycles and has other side benefits. So, and that was the whole Sandra Fluke controversy, where she was talking about a friend who needed contraception for another reason other than birth control and could not get it. And that is part of sort of the preventive medicine.
Why?
And the coverage that's supposed to happen.
But a lot of people will make the argument, and I'm obviously interested to hear what you say about this. A lot of people will say, why should insurance cover birth control? Because birth control is not expensive. Anybody can afford birth control. Why should I have to pay for someone's birth control? That's not a prohibitively expensive pill or drug or whatever people are using.
What do people think, like, prohibitively expensive mean? This is what I don't ever understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to remember that over half the people who are going to get insurance theoretically through Obamacare, who didn't have it before, make less than 133% of the poverty line, meaning that, you know, they're very, very poor. The idea that something that even costs $100 a year is nothing is somewhat odd to me. People are very poor in this country, and they need their money. And so even if you talk about something costing a couple hundred bucks, it's a lot of money. But to get the pill, you can't walk into a drugstore and just get the pill. It requires a doctor's visit, which can be very expensive. It requires some doctors won't do it without doing the yearly pap smears and everything else. All of these things cost money and require a doctor. And so there are sort of extra added fees on top of that. Condoms are relatively cheap. You can just go get a condom. You don't need anyone's permission. You don't need to do anything. You're just going to get one. But, of course, that's for men. If a woman wants, you know, to sort of have birth control that she wants to control, that requires often a physician in the way that it works in the United States. And so you have to – it is more expensive. And I would say that any amount of money is expensive to somebody.
We're talking with Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. Give him a follow. Jerry is in Arkansas. Jerry?
Good morning, Pete. How are you doing
today? Hey, Jerry, all right?
Oh, pretty good. Well, my view on this whole thing is if you're an employer providing me insurance, my job is I go to the job, I punch in the clock, and that's what you have control over. If I'm paying for that insurance out of my check, what goes on in my bedroom with my wife or my girlfriend is really none of your business.
Do you know of any controversies, Dr. Carroll, in the past, before, you know, the Affordable Care Act, where employers, you know, really wanted to pick and choose what their insurance covered because of their beliefs, whether they be religious or not? Is this an issue that comes up? Because Jerry obviously makes a great point about, hey, I go to work, you provide me with a salary and benefits. You don't get to decide how I spend the money or how I use my insurance.
Well, and this is the argument that many, especially libertarians, are making on the slippery slope. First of all, why do employers get to decide at all how you spend your money? That's what's sort of crazy, and this is part of the whole craziness of the employer-based insurance market. But, you know, if they can then say, well, I don't want you taking in and spending premiums and being allowed to buy insurance that has birth control, you know, the slippery slope is then what else can they tell you not to buy? How far can they reach into how doing this? Or, you know, can they go in another direction? If you worked for a Jehovah's Witness and they decide that blood transfusions aren't part of it, can they declare the blood transfusions and certain surgical procedures, or, you know, if certain medicines are against their religion, can they therefore say that I don't want you to have these? And can you imagine the uproar if certain religions all of a sudden declared that, like, you know, you couldn't have certain things, and employers, I mean, people would lose their minds. But that's where we're going.
But I didn't ask you that. I asked you in the past, was there an issue where insurance, where employers?
I think there probably have been cases in the past where employers tried to control what money could be spent on, and I would imagine most of them have been struck down by the courts, because that's how we get to the situation we are today, where people are free to spend their money. But you'd have to talk to, like, Eric or somebody who would know the details of what court cases have happened in.
Jerry, thank you.
You're welcome, man.
All right. Simul, you're on Stand Up in D.C.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Aaron. This is Simul, the cancer doctor in D.C. area.
Yeah, great.
So I was going to mention something about tobacco, but since you got in the birth control, I was talking with my friends about this whole thing, and you're right, it's totally political. But what about if you took birth control out of the hands of the physicians and made it a pharmacist thing? It was a pharmacist's job to talk to the patients about it and make the decision whether they could get the drugs, because it's, you know, it's pretty simple stuff. It's hormonal regulation, it's clots, a couple other things.
Right.
And then if there's a lot of generic manufacturers involved, we can get the cost down to a level of over-the-counter medications. Because, you're right, like, it's not medical. This is a political issue. Completely.
Well, I think that that's not an unreasonable thought of the way to go. The problem with that is that, you know, we've had lots of court cases and lots of laws passed, I think it's state and local levels, which basically have given pharmacists the option to refuse to sell it to people.
But hold on a second. Before we get to that, aren't we missing the point here, which is insurance covering something, covering the cost of something, in this case, the cost of preventative medicine to prevent an unwanted pregnancy, which is obviously in the interest of the employee. It's obviously in the interest of the insurance company, and certainly it's in the interest of the employer as well. So
I agree, but it's 80% covered, and if we want to avoid talking about the slippery slope, I mean, 80% of birth control is covered by Hobby Lobby and Conestoga. Those are all medications that work for the things that you're saying, to prevent pregnancies, to regulate hormones, to decrease bleeding from menstruation, and those drugs are covered. I think some of these ones that are considered extra, we could potentially have a market for it where it's outside of the clinic.
Yeah, the problem is that, you know, people want to stop even covering the former because they're saying that it's still, you have to remember that they still, if they're making an argument that it's an abortifacient, regardless of whether that argument has merit or not, they believe that sincerely no matter what. And so therefore they don't want to cover it at all. Even if it is to cover bleeding and whatnot, they don't want to cover it. Because, again, this was the whole Sandra Fluke issue. She was arguing on that issue and that issue alone, and they twisted it around immediately to be about, it was about birth control and not getting pregnant, because it's all viewed as sort of one thing. And so if they said, well, for some uses we'll cover it here, but for other uses you can go to the pharmacy, you also have to know, I believe there are lots of doctors who would you know, say, okay, you know what, I know you want this for birth control, we could all, you know, you also have some bleeding you're comparing about, let's do this, in the same way that medical marijuana has, you know, widened larger than I think it was originally intended. I know personally tons of people who get procedures that are partially elective done because they you know, they and their doctors find ways to change the billing and whatnot.
Right.
To make it so, I mean, this stuff, kind of stuff occurs, and people would argue and have argued that they don't want birth control covered at all because of that slippery slope going the other direction. But if you went the whole way and said, put this entirely in the pharmacy, it still would cost money, and I think then the battle would move, as it already has, to try to give pharmacists cover to not sell the stuff. And this has already happened, where there are pharmacists who, you know, they will pass laws saying if you don't want to give out prescriptions because of religious reasons, you don't have to. And they start denying exactly this, birth control pills or Plan B. There are studies that, although Plan B is, you know, legal for girls to buy at age 17 and 18, the pharmacists will lie. This has been done. I saw a study in JAMA. In fact, I know someone who's conducted such a study where pharmacists did not tell the truth to girls who were 17 and legally able to get it without a parent. They just refused to do it.
In Europe, birth control sold over the counter?
I bet it is, but I don't know that for sure.
Someone tweeted me that.
I think it's country by country. You have to remember, Europe is not one country with one.
Doctor, I always love when you listen. I love when you call, especially when Aaron's on. Thanks.
Have a great day.
All right. I feel like you wanted to say something else.
I don't know.
Mario in New Jersey.
Good morning, guys.
One of the greatest Twitter listeners, Twitter hybrid Twitter listeners. He is on Twitter at Mario J. Russo. And, of course, Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll. Go ahead, Mario.
So I just wanted to push back a little bit on your contention that the use of birth control for the pro-life crowd, the use of birth control should be encouraged because it lessens abortion. I agree with you 100%, but the problem is, at least with these Hobby Lobby and Conestoga people and many more, is that they feel that Plan B and IUD is abortion.
Right. They can feel however they like. Again, it's like, but that's not, you know, just because you feel like something is true.
No, I'm not talking about science here, Dr. Carroll. Pete's saying how the pro-life should crowd should approach it.
Yeah, but I would say take the Plan B out of it and just make it condoms. And I think there's often a sort of a lack of that kind of awareness. In other words, you would think they would promote whole hog condoms.
If I'm a woman, and I am, I have been in the past, just on Wednesdays.
Excellent.
I wonder what if there's any research on this, and I'm obviously not going to put Melanie on the spot. But I mean, I would want to make sure that I'm protecting myself, that I know I wouldn't want to just trust a condom necessarily, although I'm sure they do a really good job. And I don't know what the research is on their effectiveness. But, you know, you never know. You never know. And why not? And obviously, in the heat of the moment, there may not be a condom. And so you'd almost, I wonder what the idea that a lot of women, I'd love to hear from women on this, think of the concept of making sure you're in control as much as you can of your own body and therefore, you know, taking the pill or taking the morning after, the Plan B.
You guys are talking about the consequences of the, Erica a lot yesterday was talking about the consequences of the case yesterday, the implications of giving corporations the Second Amendment, freedom of religion as a corporation.
Well,
and that sort of leads into my what you talked about before about how cigarettes and e-cigarettes are marketed, Dr. Carroll.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything much about it, but I imagine that the tobacco companies and the alcohol companies must be trying to adjudicate their free speech rights to include commercial speech, right, to be able to actually advertise wherever they want if they have free speech.
But cigarettes have long had that curtailed. Like, they cannot advertise. You do not see cigarette ads on TV.
You do not see, cigarette ads sort of like on billboards really anymore. You don't really see cigarette ads when you watch, like, sports games. It's like the ways that you can advertise for tobacco cigarettes have been sharply curtailed over time, and they just know that's the case.
Yeah, they used to have their political speech curtailed,
yeah.
too.
Well, and that, so they can go argue that in the courts, but they're not doing that. What they're doing is just trying to declare that you know, e-cigarettes are a different animal and should be in some ways protected and you know, not subject to that. That is what I just don't think you declare that. I think you prove that. And so, you know, that is...
I think we're going to see that in the courts pretty soon, actually.
Oh.
I don't think they're going to. I do not believe tobacco is ever going to come and try to fight to get their advertising back.
Wow, look at this.
There'd be a monstrous public backlash. And I don't think that they're going to want to do that at all.
My brother, who doesn't listen to the show very much these days, but has been lately, says, Aaron, listen to this, attacking Aaron Carroll. I love it. AC, so wrong on e-cigarettes. It's stunning. He knows they're not as dangerous as cigarettes. There's no hypothesis for how they could be. That's why no one is funding studies.
What? Okay. I'm glad he knows that is why they're not funding studies. But it is a nicotine product, and I don't know why you would not think that there could be some reason to believe it could be as addictive.
He knows they're not as dangerous as cigarettes.
I just said that. I said that there's evidence that shows they're not as dangerous. I'm not concerned that they are going to cause everyone to have cancer. I am concerned that they do not have the properties of getting everybody to quit and that they could be addictive and that they could lead in the other direction, especially because they're not that the restrictions against marketing are not as strong and kids are taking them up like
crazy. He says, so why regulate something when there's no reason to believe it's harmful?
I just said I do think there's reason to believe it's harmful. Just because something doesn't cause cancer doesn't mean that it's not, or in the
Got
same
it.
Rates as tobacco, as cigarettes, doesn't mean it's not harmful.
Dr. Carroll?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a quick ACA question?
Sure.
So when we talk about risk pools,
yes,
is the – so Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield New Jersey has four plans, let's say, in New Jersey, right?
Mm-hmm.
A couple bronzes, one platinum, one gold.
Yep.
Is the risk pool for the individual plan or for all the plans in their under their umbrella?
Well, what what the companies have to do every year is the way that they have to think about it is that anybody can go into any plan. But over time, they will change the prices of those plans on a yearly basis based upon what they spent and how bad their pool was for that plan.
Okay.
So you will see, you know, if all the sick people go to the platinum plan, the next year the platinum plan is going to go up in price. And if all the sick people go into the bronze plan, the next year the bronze plan is going to go up in price. And that theoretically would drive people into other plans. And so there will be shifting around, but they are all considered open in that anybody can go to them. So the insurance companies have to be much more savvy in how they do the calculations. But, you know, every insurance company is going to be calculating the price of its premiums for the next year based upon what they had to spend and how sick the pool was for that plan in the year before.
All right, Mario, as always, we appreciate it. I've got to take a break. But when we come back, Dr. Aaron Carroll stays with us. There was a lot of concern, obviously, about the Affordable Care Act for 1,000 different reasons. Some of it's legitimate. Some of it obviously is not. One concern is that, do I have this right? Because I want to talk about your, that physicians would opt out of Medicare. And when we've got research on physicians and whether or not they've formally opted out of Medicare. And Dr. Carroll will tell us what those statistics are when we come back, right?
Sure.
All right, we'll be right back. Follow Aaron on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. Two R's, two L's. We'll be right back.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
Yeah, Dr. Aaron Carroll, your favorite doctor, is joining us. Are you following him on Twitter? If you're not, you should be at
hello.
Aaron E. Carroll. Hi. Who are you saying hello to?
It was all super quiet. I didn't know what was.
Oh, you didn't hear the music yet. I heard it. You didn't hear it. By the way, Dr. Aaron Carroll, now contributor to the New York Times. Very exciting, as well as his blog, The Incidental Economist. And he continues to make his healthcare triage videos, HC triage. Share them with your friends. You posted one yesterday. It gets like 77,000 views already.
Crazy. That one just went crazy. I don't know what was up.
What is that one about? The milk?
Milk, yeah.
Everybody should check these out. He's a myth buster. He's a truth teller, a fact checker. He joins us now. before the break, and we got a couple more calls I want to get to, of course, so hold on, guys. But before the break, I mentioned what?
While everyone keeps, like, you know, it's just interesting to me because when we talk about sort of the regulation of e-cigarettes, I almost just want to say out loud what we're talking about. So basically, all I'm arguing is that I think it needs to be looked at by the FDA. I just don't think it should be let go. Like, in other words, things like this, the FDA regulates, they have to sort of list the ingredients in their products. They have to get prior approval for new products. They have to restrict online sales. They have to restrict marketing for children. That's what we're talking about, and that's what everybody's freaking out about. And I'm not saying ban them or do anything else. I just think that it's a nicotine product that is, you know, there is no sort of reason to believe, and really no evidence yet that proves that it's conclusively this universal good. It should be regulated in the way that those things are regulated. And if you don't think so, that's fine. But I think that people are sort of arguing as if, like, it, one, has no downside whatsoever, and two, needs not to be looked at all. It should just be free reign. The company should go. And I just don't see that. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, we were going to talk about the physicians opting out of Medicare.
Yeah.
You have a post at the Incidental Economist. Less than 1% of physicians have formally opted out of Medicare. I guess I don't remember what the claim or insinuation or threat was.
Every year, you know, when the doc fix comes up and they talk about, you know, that Medicare doesn't reimburse enough and that how Medicare, you know, doesn't pay enough and doctors can't survive on it and the government's too chintzy, you hear all the time about some horror story about some practice or some doctor who's going to refuse to take Medicare patients or some state, Arizona, picket, whatever it is, there's going to be no one taking Medicare patients, that, you know, that there'll be no one left and it's going to be terrible. And it's just interesting that, you know, when the data reports come out every year, no one pays attention at all. And so this was the Kaiser Family Foundation sort of releasing a report talking about the numbers. And in the last year, less than 1% of physicians formally opted out of Medicare, and more than 40% of those physicians were psychiatrists.
But let's be clear, just so, because I got confused for a minute. It doesn't mean 40% of psychiatrists are opting out of Medicare. It means that 40% of the doctors.
40% of doctors. So
40% of the less than 1% of doctors that are opting out of Medicare are psychiatrists.
Almost half of the less than 1% of physicians that opt out of Medicare are psychiatrists, which means that, you know, the other half or 60% of the less than 1%. I mean, it's an incredibly, incredibly small number. Not only that, but Medicare beneficiaries are incredibly well, you know, plugged into their doctors. I think it was like 4% of Medicare beneficiaries don't have a usual source of care, meaning 96% do. That is stunning. 88% of Medicare beneficiaries can usually or always get an appointment as soon as they want it. That doesn't even come close to sort of the rest of the national.
Is that too far for me to jump to say that, you know, a lot of concerns that Americans have about the Canadian system, which is called Medicare, which is single payer, is that they would have to wait to get an appointment forever.
Well, that's the thing. If they blame that on single payer, that is not – the Canadian system does not have wait times, and even those are overblown. But it does not have wait times because it's a single payer system. It does not. It has wait times because they restrict supply in an effort to keep spending down. That's it. It has nothing to do with the single payerness.
Mm.
It has only to do with how much they want to spend and how much they want to save. You're exactly right. We have a single payer system for the elderly, and they don't have wait times. 92% of Medicare beneficiaries could usually or always get an appointment with a specialist as soon as they need it. You try calling up with your private insurance and see how quickly you can get a specialist appointment as soon as you need it.
Okay. Get them on the phone right now, Chris.
There's often a huge wait. Medicare beneficiaries do fantastically because almost all doctors take Medicare, and not all doctors take all private insurance plans. So it is often easier to get an appointment with the single-payer plan in the United States than it is for tons of private insurance plans because almost no doctors don't take Medicare.
I've got my my gastroenterologist on the phone right now. Dr. Kentology, is that you?
Yes, Pete. Hello.
Can I get an appointment today at 7?
No.
Okay. You're right. You are right, Dr. Carroll. It is very hard. Let's go to Scott.
We've proven it.
We've proven it right here. Scott in Ohio.
Good morning, guys. I have a question. I'd like to sort of swing back around to cigarettes for a minute.
Yes.
Oh, here we go.
Not on the e-cig thing, although I think e-cigs will ultimately be a good thing down the road, but companies restricting their employees' ability to smoke in the workplace, that seems reasonable and fine to me. But there have been numerous court cases now where the courts have ruled that employers have the right to fire employees who are found to be smoking in their off hours.
In their own time, on their own private time?
In their own time in a legal way? Okay, I would need to see that, because that seems extreme.
I see the story. I will dig it up. I think it was a court case in Michigan. And I know there are numerous companies that refuse to hire employees that smoke. And that seems to be legal.
I would have to, like, know. First of all, that on a personal level, speaking only for me, that seems extreme.
Smokers need not apply here. CBS News, one Michigan company where there is smoke, you're fired. If you test positive for tobacco, you lose your job.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Talk about that with Eric as well, because I cannot imagine how that passes, like, the sniff test of legality. I don't know, but I agree that that seems extreme, nor am I arguing for that.
But, yeah, and of course, obviously.
Oh, by the way, that reminds me, Alfred, you're fired.
Well, do you need a reason to fire him?
Yeah, well, no, he wasn't smoking. A lot of ice cream consumption for this fella.
Massive incompetence, just isn't that enough?
How dare you?
That was hurtful.
I have to defend
him. I'm going to eat my feelings with this ice cream now.
And I guess that sort of raises my question with the part of the Hobby Lobby thing is, we seem to have entered into this era where, you know, yes, there's all this talk about government taking over your healthcare decisions, but the same people who scream about that seem to be perfectly okay with a corporation deciding your healthcare decisions.
Yeah, I'm not okay with either. So it's like,
I'm not either. And, you know, whether it's birth control, whether it's tobacco and nicotine, it certainly seems to me we're heading down the slope for, you know, people with a BMI above this need not apply, people with a genetic predisposition for sickle cell need not apply, and there seems to be almost zero discussion about how incredibly dangerous something like that
would be. Well, I think that this, again, brings up the point. It's like, and this, you will have a hard time finding many economists or a large number of economists who don't agree that we absolutely positively should decouple insurance from employment, that there is no good rational reason anymore that for some, how people get health care and insurance has to be tied up with employment. And if we would just do that, if we could just decouple it in some way, a lot of these arguments would just go away. And that would be the single best thing we could do. But it would be disruptive, and it would be difficult to transition in the short term, and that alone is going to make it difficult, because at this point, both sides would make such hay out of, oh, you didn't get to keep the plan you liked that you had at your job, that it would be very difficult to move from one way to the other. But there's no question that, like, decoupling this would be a good thing, and getting this, you know, out of the idea that your employer could step in and make any decisions about your health care. Why should they? That, of course, makes no sense at all. We should absolutely be ending that.
So I cannot make any decisions about any Chris, Melanie, or Alfred, about what they do in their free time?
I don't know. Maybe you could, but I don't think that you should have – I don't think you should be deciding anything about their health care. It makes no sense. In the same way, it's like you shouldn't get to decide how they spend their money once they make it.
Well, I certainly manage that. You owe Alfred an apology. You were hurtful.
Alfred,
you said he was. You said he was incompetent. He's the greatest producer in radio.
I now overcompensating. Now I actually feel offended.
Scott, thank you.
It wasn't real. Now it's real.
I said massively incompetent. Right.
Let's go to Lance in Virginia. Lance.
Hi, Pete. Thanks for taking my call. Hi,
yeah.
Dr. Carroll.
Hi.
I want to say the reason why we don't go to Medicare for All single payer is because of the Hyde Amendment. We'd have taxpayers claiming that you can't cover abortion, you can't cover contraception with their tax dollars through a single-payer system.
Well,
my point about I'll let you talk to that in a second. My other point was about e-cigarettes. The human lungs at all, are a gas exchange system, and they are meant to have air in them, and that's all they are supposed to take in. Anything else that goes into your lungs have to work to expel. And they're not really well designed for that. So that tends to cause inflammation.
Speak for your own lungs, sir. Yeah. My lungs are awesome. I can take in any kind of gas and spit it right back out and as fire.
Oil, not liquid. If your lungs have to work at that, I think that causes inflammation. I'm not an oncologist, but I believe that inflammation is the first.
It does. It is a pretty convincing argument. But what does the science say? You know, I mean,
this is still the way the United States works. There are lots of things which will raise the risk of my having problems with my health that I still do, that you still do, that everyone still does, because we are allowed to make individual choices. I only want to sort of, I just think that there's levels at which we say that we have to put in measures to sort of protect health or protect those who need protection, like children, to regulate it to make sure that we keep things to a reasonable standard of health. And that, in other words, I'm not suggesting we ban cigarettes.
You want to take all of the fun out of life.
I don't.
Doctors like you.
I think sometimes you need a little extra.
Listen to this, by the way. I wanted to mention this earlier. I didn't. There's a new study by the World Health Organization that says 3.7 million deaths in 2012 were caused by outdoor air pollution. But this is even crazier. 4.3 million were caused by indoor air pollution, mainly from coal or dung-powered stoves in some of the world's poorest countries. Do you, now, a study like that, I wonder how they're even able to conduct that. How are they able to say that someone died because of air pollution?
They can sort of extrapolate from different, and those studies are always subject to people contesting them because of the reasons you just brought up. You can't prove, you know, conclusively that someone died, unless you do autopsies on tons of people. So what they do is they'll do it on a small number of people, and then they will extrapolate it out based upon the world population and everything that's going on. And they do that for effect. I mean, they do that to sort of bring, you know, the idea that we know, you know, that this is a real problem and that it's killing a significant number of people. But of course, saying, you know, exactly knowing that this is what killed you versus that's what killed you is always somewhat problematic.
We're out of time. Thank you, sir.
Oh, wow. It went fast.
I think so. Yeah. E-cigarettes. People fired up.
I'm telling you, man.
Yeah. It is, including my brother. I hope he listened to your response. He clearly misunderstood you. But.
Well, I don't think so. I think that, you know, people are just incredibly passionate about it and want, you know. Just
to be fair, my brother wrote as a qualifier. He said, I think anybody who smokes an e-cigarette is a D-bag. Don't get me wrong. Which is awesome. And I agree. I mean, there should be a brand of e-cigarettes called for douches. Dr. Aaron Carroll is on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. If you're listening now, follow him. If you're listening on the replay, even more, follow him. Thanks, as always, for your time. That's how we pay him, and Twitter followers. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Watch his YouTube videos at HC Triage. Read him at The Incidental Economist and The New York Times, where he is now a contributor.